Captain Neal said. Last but not least, if any of you have genuine information which might help in this investigation, of course we will appreciate your reporting that information to me or one of the people working with me. Someone at Hendricks Plantation murdered Walter March this morning with premeditation. No one has been allowed to leave the plantation since this morning. Someone here, most likely in this room, is guilty of first-degree murder. I will appreciate your cooperation in every way. Captain Neal started from the microphone, bent back to it, and said, "Thank you." "Good old boy," said Bob. "Good cop." "Bright and decent," said Crystal. Freddie Arbuthnot said, "Ineffectual." Helena said Hi Litwack needed no introduction, and so she gave him none. Bob McConnell said, "I bet he says don't shoot the messenger." Crystal and Fletch shrugged at each other. Hi Litwack, anchorman for Evening Network News, was highly respected by everyone except other journalists, most of whom were purely envious of him. He was handsome, dignified, with a grand voice, solid manner, and had been earning a fabulous annual income for many years. He was staffed like no journalist in history had ever been staffed. An additional point of envy was that he was also an incredibly good journalist. Unlike many other television newsmen, he kept his showmanship to a minimum. And unlike many other journalists of roughly comparable power and prestige, there was minimal evidence of bias in his reporting, even in the questions he asked in live interview situations. He never led his audience or anyone he was interviewing. Also enviable was his on-camera stamina through conventions, elections, and other continuous coverage stories. Hi Litwack had been at the top of the heap for years. Next to him at the table sat his wife, Carol.
"Good evening." The famous voice cleared his throat. "When I have an opportunity to speak, I try to speak on the topics I find people most frequently ask me about, whether I wish to speak about them or not. Recently, people have been asking me most about acts of terrorism, more specifically about television news coverage of acts of terrorism, most specifically whether by covering terrorism, television news is encouraging or even causing other terrorists to implement their dreadful, frequently insane fantasies. I hate witnessing terrorism. I hate reading about it. I hate reporting it, as I'm sure we all do. But television did not create terrorism. Terrorism, like many another crime or insanity, is infectious. It perpetuates itself. It causes itself to happen. One incident of terrorism causes two more incidents, which cause more and more and more incidents. Never was this social phenomenon of acts of terrorism stimulating other acts of terrorism, on and on, more apparent than at the beginning of the 20th century. And television, or television news, at that point had not yet even been dreamed of. An act of terrorism is an event. It is news. And it is our job to bring that news to the people, whether we personally like that news or not."
Bob McConnell whispered, "Here it comes."
"Blaming television," Hi Litwack continued, "for causing acts of terrorism simply by reporting them is as bad as shooting the messenger simply because the news he brings is bad."
Chapter 11. In the privacy of their bedroom, Carol Litwack was saying to her husband, "Live to be 100, I'll never get over it."
"Over what?"
"You, I don't know." At a distance, there was a sound of gargling. Before leaving for dinner, Fletch had tuned the receiver to Leona Hatch's room, room 42, so he could check on her later, making sure she was as comfortable as possible. All he had expected to hear on the tape was snoring and... But that wasn't the way the marvelous machine worked. Like all things governmental, it had its own system of priorities. It took him a while to figure it out. First, he heard Leona Hatch snoring in room 42 on station 22. Then station 21 lit, and he heard Sheldon Levy's toilet flushing in room 48. Then station 4 lit, and he heard Eleanor Earls saying in suite 9, "Dressed to hear Hi Litwack's stupid speech. Ugh. But if I don't, I suppose there'll be 3 pages in TV Guide about my snubbing the pan-fried son of a bitch at the American Journalism." And then station 2 lit, and he heard Carol and Hi Litwack talking in suite 5. Any noise in any room in which he had placed a lower-numbered bug had precedence over any noise in any room in which he had placed a higher-numbered bug. Fletch studied his telephone information sheet and the notes he had made on it regarding which bugs he had put where, and discovered he had placed bugs instinctively more or less in accordance with the machine's priorities. To keep himself straight at what he was doing, and in fear of eventually being caught as he let himself into other people's rooms, he had planted the lower-numbered bugs in the rooms of the more important people. Station 1 was Suite 12, Lydia March and Walter March, Jr. Station 2, the Litwax, in Suite 5. Station 3, Helena and Jake Williams, in Suite 7. Station 4, Eleanor Earls, in Suite 9. In Suite 3, now empty, it being where Walter March had been murdered, he had placed bug number 5. And in room 77, Frederica Arbuthnot's, he had placed bug number 23. "My, my," Fletch said of his marvelous machine. "It walks, it talks, cries mama, and piddles genuine orange juice." High Litwax spent a long time gargling his famous throat, every bubble and burp of which Fletch faithfully recorded. Carol Litwack was saying, "Here you are, the most successful, respected journalist in the country, in the whole world, a multimillionaire on top of that, and you still feel you can't say what you want to say, what you think is the truth."
"Like what?"
High Litwack's voice sounded tired and bored.
"Well, what you just said about terrorism and television downstairs is not what you said to me about terrorism and television."
Clearly, High Litwack was having a bedtime conversation with his wife, which did not interest him much.
"I mentioned the possibility that the more publicity we give terrorists and murders, the more other kooks are apt to commit acts of terror and murder for the publicity alone. Too many people want to be on television, even with a gun in the hand, or in handcuffs, or lying face down in the street with their backs riddled with police bullets. How much more of my speech would you like me to repeat to you? I admitted all that. I said I worry about it, but I don't know what to do about it. No one does. News is news, and it's seldom good."
It was a feminine sigh.
"That's not what you've said to me at all."
"What have I said different?"
"Hi, you know you have. Time after time you've said to me the networks give maximum exposure to acts of terrorism in progress because it gets the ratings up."
Hi Litwack said,
"They make for good drama.
People tune in especially to see if the hostages or whoever have gotten machine gunned yet, or had their heads chopped off. You know you said this."
"Yes," Hi Litwack said. "I've said this to you."
"You didn't say it tonight. In your speech, an ongoing act of terrorism and the whole network news department comes alive. You rush to the studio day or night, people switch on their TV sets, audience ratings go up."
"I said they make for good drama."
"The advertisers' commercials get more exposure," Carol said. "Here some little nut out in Chicago or Cleveland is holding 20 people hostage to protest the establishment in some way, and in boardrooms all across the country the establishment is cheering because the poor little nut is helping to sell the establishment's products to all the other nuts and thus make the establishment richer."
"Everything makes the establishment richer."
"You said that to me. Why didn't you say it in your speech tonight? Are you so establishment yourself you can't say what you really think as a journalist?"
"No," said High Litwack, "but I'm a good enough journalist to keep my cynicism to myself."
There was what seemed to Fletch a long silence. He was waiting to hear where the marvelous machine would switch next. He was about to experiment to see if he could run the machine manually when he again heard Carol Litwack's voice.
"Oh, High, you don't know what I'm talking about."
"I guess not,"
said the famous voice, now sleepy. "This afternoon you rush down here to Virginia early and immediately tape that phony eulogy on Walter March for the network evening news. 'The great journalist Walter March of March Newspapers is dead,' you intoned. 'Shockingly murdered at the convention of the American Journalism Alliance, of which March was the elected president.'"
"I never said shockingly murdered."
"You even put on your tight throat bit."
"You can check the tape."
"Whatever you said."
"Whatever I said."
"You didn't even know Walter March, really."
"No man is an island."
"The few times you met him, you told me the same thing about him. He was a cold fish."
"Carol, would you mind if we went to sleep now?"
"You're not listening."
"No, I'm not."
Just because all you famous news people are here, because it's a cheap story, cheap drama, because you're competing with each other between martinis, you're giving Walter March's murder more publicity than World War II.
Carol!
The famous voice was no longer sleepy. It sounded as if someone had just declared World War III.
You still don't know what I'm saying.
Do I have to sleep in the living room?
You don't know what you're doing, Carol said. You can't.
Carol?
Giving March's murder all this publicity. All you're doing is inciting some other kook, maybe hundreds of publicity-hungry kooks, to see if they can stick a knife or scissors or whatever into the back of some other, quote, great American journalist, unquote.
Carol, for God's sake!
There was another long silence. Then Carol Litwack's voice said, I just hope the next, quote, great American journalist, unquote, murdered isn't you. Fletch switched to Station 22 and heard only one in 3 minutes of snores. He discovered that if he depressed a station button and shoved it up a little, it would catch and remain on that station. On Station 23, he heard the shower running and Frederica Arbuthnot singing a little ditty that apparently went, Hoo boy, now I wash my left knee. Hoo boy, now I wash my right knee. Fletch said, Hoo boy, nice knees, treacherous heart. Fletch scanned the other stations. There was conversation on Station 8 in syndicated humorist Oscar Perlman's suite.
Like this and $5 and you couldn't even get a good dollar cigar. There's a good dollar cigar now.
I'm in, too.
Three little words, make 'em nice.
Nice, one, two, three, those are nice.
You're asking, you tell them.
I deal without prejudice.
Litwack.
Oscar Perlman had written a play and a few books and had been on television often, and his was the only voice Fletch recognized. Listening, Fletch could not even be sure how many men were in the room. He presumed they were all Washington newspapermen.
Fucking phony. Who's talking about Litwack?
You recognize the description? I'm out.
He's just good-looking, said Perlman.
He's no journalist, he's just an actor.
All us plug uglies are jealous of him, said Perlman, because he's good-looking.
He's no actor either. Anybody see him jerking himself off over March's death on the evening Ersatz news show?
Ersatz? What's that, Ersatz?
There's no business like show business. That's news.
How much of Litwack's income comes from his face, Walter?
His face and his voice? 30%. 90%, Oscar, 90%.
He looks like everybody's father, as last seen, laid out in a coffin.
Whose deal? Something all you guys are too jealous to recognize, said Oscar Perlman, is that High Litwack is a good journalist.
A good journalist?
Don't bother unfolding right now. Your dealing has driven me to drink.
Shit.
Oscar, I thought I saw you sitting downstairs listening to High Litwack's speech. In fact, I thought I saw you sitting next to me.
I was there.
You heard that speech and still tell us you think High Litwack is a good, honest, no-bullshit journalist?
Someone else said, That speech was written for some afternoon ladies' society out in Ohio, not for his colleagues, Oscar.
That's true. Hit me once, and hit me twice, and hit me once again. It's been a long, long time.
Fucking superior bastard.
So, Oscar Perlman said, He's not the first speaker who misjudged his audience. What are you going to do, wrap a coaxial cable around his neck and turn on the juice?
At least he might have asked one of his 3,000 staff members to write a new speech for us.
Another reason you're all jealous of him, said Oscar Perlman, is because High Litwack has a big six-figure income.
There was a momentary silence. Someone said quietly, So have you, Oscar.
Yeah, but you bastards have figured out a way of taking it away from me, over the poker table.
There was a laugh.
Oscar's defending High because they're both establishment, two richest men in journalism.
That's right, said Oscar. Only Litwack's smarter than I am. He doesn't play poker.
You gonna do a column on Walter March's death, Oscar?
I don't see anything funny about getting a pair of scissors up the ass. Even I can't make anything funny out of that.
You can't?
Pair of deuces, pair of rockets. And the devils are up and away, Five Card Charlie.
No, said Oscar Perlman. I can't.
How much money has Walter March cost you, Oscar?
It's not the money, it's the grief.
Sizable bill. First when you were working for him in Washington, for years March refused to syndicate you. He wouldn't even let your column run in other March newspapers.
He said what was funny in Washington, no one would think funny in Dallas.
He was wrong about Dallas. Then, when the syndicate picked you up, he sued you, saying you developed a column while working on his newspaper, and he had the original copyright.
No one ever got rich working for Walter March.
How much did all that cost you, Oscar?
Nothing.
Nothing?
You can't sue talent.
You didn't buy him off?
Of course not.
Legal fees?
There was some.
Grief?
A lot. I'll never forgive him. Frankly, I'll never forgive him, never.
Then immediately he started nudging, saying if your column was going to run, it had to run in his newspapers, right?
The bastard threatened about every contract I've had with every newspaper in this country.
This has been going on for years and years, right, Oscar?
What are you doing, playing cards or working on a story?
I don't get it, said another voice. So Walter March has been biting your tail all these years. Why all the grief? Lawyers are for grief. You can't afford lawyers, Oscar.
You don't know how Walter March operated?
Look at that, 910 Queen. Tell me.
If you don't know how Walter March operated, you never worked for him.
Yeah, I only need one.
A little blackmail. Always a little blackmail.
Someone else said, that son of a bitch had more private eyes on his payroll than he had reporters. Paid him better, too. And they didn't have to write. A cute man, real cute. Shit, son of a bitch, I'm out.
You mean Walter March has been blackmailing you, Oscar?
No, just trying to find a way to. Pair of eyes behind every bush.
I'm flying first class. There's always the same son of a bitch flying coach. No matter what city I'm in, there's always someone waiting for me in the hotel lobby to see if I go up in the elevator alone. Nuisance value, you know.
Dear old saintly Walter March operated like that.
Dear old saintly Walter March, the president of your American Journalism Alliance. You voted for him? Give me one card, so long as it's the King of Clubs.
I'm very grateful to him, said Oscar Perlman. Kept me straight all these years. I've never had the opportunity to lie to my wife.
Oscar, you don't think dear old saintly Walter March getting a scissors up the ass is funny?
Oscar Perlman said,
not worth a column.
I take it we're not sleeping together?
Fletch said into the phone, who is this?
It was 1:20 a.m. He had been asleep a half hour.
Damn you, said Freddy Arbuthnot. Damn your eyes, your nose, and your cock.
The phone went dead. It wasn't that Fletch hadn't thought of it. He knew she'd washed her knees.
Chapter 12. Tuesday, 8:30 a.m. Prayer breakfast. Conservatory. And in the morning, the phone was ringing as he entered his room. He took off his sweaty T-shirt before answering.
Have you seen the papers? Crystal asked.
No, I went for a ride.
Ride? You're unemployed and you rented a car?
I'm unemployed and I rented a horse. They use less gas.
A horse? You mean one of those big things with four legs who eat hay?
That's a cow, Fletch said.
Or a horse.
It took Crystal a moment more of exclamations before accepting the idea that someone would get up before dawn, find the stables in the dark, rent a horse, and ride over the hills eastward watching the sunrise, without a thought for breakfast. It had been a pleasant horse and a great sunrise. And taking the horse from the stables and bringing it back, Fletch had not seen the man in the blue denim jacket with tight curly gray hair who had approached the masseuse, Mrs. Leary, in the parking lot 2 mornings before and asked her about the arrival of Walter March.
I want to read you just one graph from Bob McConnell's story in March's Washington newspaper regarding the old bastard's murder.
Pretty extensive coverage?
Pages and pages. 2 pages, just of photographs, going back to and including a shot of the bastard at the baptismal font.
He deserves every line, said Fletch. Dear old saintly Walter March.
Anyway, Bob nailed you.
Yeah?
I'll just read the paragraph. First, he names all the big names here at the convention. Then he writes, "Also attending the convention is Irwin Maurice Fletcher, who, although never indicted, previously has figured prominently in murder trials in the states of California and Massachusetts. Currently unemployed, Fletcher has worked for a March newspaper." Fletcher was pulling off his jeans. He had listened to McConnell phoning in his story the night before. "A pretty heavy tat for tit, Fletcher. He thinks you'll not jokingly accuse Bob McConnell of first-degree murder again, at least not in his presence." "Who was joking?" "There's some pretty vicious people around here," Crystal said. "You didn't know?" "Breakfast?" "Got a shower first." "Please do." Chapter 13. 9:30 a.m. Is God dead or just depressed? Address by Right Reverend James Halford, Conservatory. 10 a.m. Is anyone out there? Weekly newspapers group discussion. Bobby Joe Hendricks Cocktail Lounge. Fletch had breakfast in his room, listening to Virginia State Police Captain Andrew Neal questioning Lydia March and Walter March, Jr., in Suite 12. There were the preliminary courtesies, Captain Neal saying, "I know this must be terribly difficult for you, Mrs. March." Lydia saying, "I know it's necessary." His saying, "Thank you. You have my sympathy. I would avoid disturbing you at this point if it were at all possible." While Fletch was spooning his half a grapefruit, Junior had to be fetched from his bedroom. "Junior's a little slow this morning," Lydia said. "Neither of us is getting any sleep, of course." "Hello, Mr. Neal," Junior said. His voice was not as clear as Lydia's or Neal's. "Good morning, Mr. March. I've told your mother that you have my sympathy, and I hate to put you both through this." "Right," Junior said. "Hate to go through it. Hate to go through the whole shabby thing." "If you would just go over the circumstances of your husband's... You don't mind my using a tape recorder, do you?" Junior said, "Tape recorder?" "Of course not, Captain Neal. Do anything you like." "As an aid to my memory, and hopefully so I won't have to disturb you again. It's most important that we fix the timing of this incident precisely." "Incident?" said Junior. "Sorry," said Neal. "All words are inadequate." "Apparently," said Junior. "We're particularly interested in..." "I'll do my best, Captain," Lydia said, "only it's so..." "Mrs. March, if you can just describe everything, every detail, from the moment you woke up yesterday morning." "Yes, well, we... That is, Walter and I were scheduled to have breakfast at 8 o'clock yesterday morning with Helena and Jake Williams. Helena is the executive secretary of the Alliance. To go over everything a final time before the mobs arrived, you know, and discuss any problems there might have been." "Were there any you knew of?"
"Any what?"
"Any problems?"
"No, not really. There was a small problem about the president."
"The president of what?"
"The United States."
"Oh, what was that?"
"What was what?"
"The problem with the president of the United States."
"Oh, well, you see, he doesn't play golf."
"I know."
"Well, you see, he was scheduled to arrive at 3 p.m. by helicopter. The problem was what to do with him until dinner. Presidents of the United States have always played golf. Almost always. At these conventions, the president goes out and walks around the golf course with a few members of the press, and it makes a good picture opportunity for the working press, and it makes it seem to the public that we're doing something for him, helping him to relax, giving him a break from work, and that the press and the president can be friendly, you know."
"I see."
"But the president, this president, doesn't play golf. The night before, Jake, that's Mr. Williams, over drinks... Well, we were talking about this, and Jake was making silly suggestions of what to do with the President of the United States for 4 hours. He suggested we fill up the swimming pool with catfish and give the President a net and let him wade in and catch them all. I should be saying this. Oh, Junior, help."
"What did you decide?"
"I think they were deciding to put up softball teams, the President and Secret Service and all that, against some reporters. Only Hendricks Plantation doesn't have a softball field, of course. Who has?" "And Jake was saying what would happen if the President of the United States got beamed by the Associated Press."
"Really, Mr. Neal," Junior said.
"Right," Neal said. "Mrs. March..." "At least the Vice President plays golf," she said.
"And what time did you wake up, Mrs. March?"
"I'm not sure. 7:15, 7:20. I heard the door to the suite close."
"That was me, Mr. Neal," Junior said. "I went down to the lobby to get the newspapers."
Walter had left his bed. It's always been a thing with him to be up a little earlier than I. a masculine thing. I heard him moving around the bathroom. I lay in bed a little while, a few minutes really, waiting for him to be done.
The bathroom door was closed?
Yes, in a moment I heard the television here in the living room go on, softly, one of those morning news and feature network shows Walter always hated so much, so I got up and went into the bathroom. Excuse me, how did your husband get from the bathroom to the living room without coming back through your bedroom?
He went through Junior's bedroom, of course. He didn't want to disturb me.
Mrs. March, are you saying that, in fact, you did not see your husband at all yesterday morning?
Oh, Captain Neal.
I'm sorry, I mean alive.
No, I didn't.
Then how did you know he was in the bathroom yesterday morning?
Captain, we've been married 50 years. You get used to the different sounds of your family. You know them even in a hotel suite.
Okay. You were in the bathroom. The television was playing softly in the living room.
I heard the door to the suite close again, so I thought Walter had gone down for coffee.
Had the television gone off?
No.
So actually someone could have come into the suite at that point?
No. At first I thought Junior might have come back, but he couldn't have.
Why not?
I didn't hear them talking.
Would they have been talking, necessarily?
Of course, about the headlines, the newspapers, the bulletins on the television. My husband and son are newspaper men, Captain Neal. Every day there are new developments.
Yes, of course.
After getting the newspapers, Junior said, I went into the coffee shop and had breakfast.
So, Mrs. March, you think you heard the suite door close again, but your husband hadn't left the suite, and you think no one entered the suite because you didn't hear talking?
I guess that's right. I could be mistaken, of course. I'm trying to reconstruct.
Pardon, but where were you physically in the bathroom when you heard the door close the second time?
I was getting into the tub. I don't shower in the morning. I discovered years ago that if I take a shower in the morning, I can never get my hair organized again for the whole day.
Yes. You had already run the tub?
Yes, while I was brushing my teeth, and all that.
So there must have been a period of time, while the tub was running, that you couldn't have heard anything from the living room. Not the front door, not the television, not talking.
I suppose not.
So the second time you heard the door close, when you were getting into the tub, you actually could have been hearing someone leaving the suite.
Oh, my, that's right, of course.
It would explain your son's not having returned, your husband's not having left, and you're not hearing talking.
How clever you are.
Then what? You were sitting in the tub.
I'm not sure. I think I heard the door open again. I believe I did, because later when I went into the living room, when I... the door to the corridor was open.
All right, Mother.
I'm sorry, Captain Neal. This is difficult.
Would you like to take a break, get some coffee, something? Would you like an eye-opener, Captain Neal?
An eye-opener?
I'm making myself a Bloody Mary, Junior said.
Oh, no, Junior, Lydia March said.
A little early for me, Neal said.
Let's get it over with, Lydia said.